Dr. Rowan Williams, you're here in Naples attending this interfaith meeting sponsored by St. Egidio on the theme for a world without violence. And yet so often, as we know, religion is seen as the cause, the source of violence, rather than a solution. What do you really see as the significance of a meeting like this?
I think St. Egidio has a remarkable track record in simply getting people into conversation about basic things around their faith without compromising, without entering into negotiating mode, but finding the sort of language we can speak in common to make sense of one another. And that has to be a major contribution to breaking down prejudice and the sort of mutual fear that surrounds this subject. I think that it's perfectly true in many ways that bad religion is a very ready-to-hand tool for bad people. And bad religion, because it carries with it some of that absolutism and, what should one say, that unwillingness to compromise that's rooted in a rather insecure kind of faith, that's a very powerful tool for people to use against each other. So it's all the more important that good religion, if one dare say that, religion which is more concerned about God than keeping oneself safe, that comes in to drive it out. You can't just do it by secularism.
You're talking particularly about the role of scriptures, aren't you, in the three monotheistic faiths. In a world where so often gestures seem to speak much louder than words, what do you see as the importance, perhaps, of the study of scriptures in interfaith dialogue today?
In very general terms, if we don't watch and listen to each other engaging with scripture, we're not seeing the most important things in each other's faith. And that it's been a major principle in the sort of interfaith dialogues I've myself been involved in the last few years, that we spend a lot of time watching one another read the Quran or the Bible, because they've been mostly Christian-Muslim events. But I think more generally, and I'm going to try and say this on Monday, all the scriptures of the monotheistic faiths, at least, assume that communities of faith get things wrong, that they're repeatedly falling away from what they're called to do, that they need to be focused not on themselves but on God in order to be restored. And that's what scriptural stories are about. Now, if we can read our scriptures together with that spirit, recognizing that they're actually about the mistakes people like us make, in such a way as to drive us back to God and rely on God's gift and God's revelation, then I think there's something that the very fact of scripture teaches us and helps us with.
There are many panels, workshops, discussions going on here in a very public way. There's also a lot of meetings going on, I know, behind the scenes, behind closed doors and so on. Do you have any particular hopes for meetings of this kind here this week?
Well, certainly I'll be meeting a number of people this weekend. I hope to meet Cardinal Casper again, of course, to talk about our ecumenical work. I hope to meet Cardinal Turon to talk a little bit about the wider dimensions of the interfaith question and various other folk. But for me, there are two particular issues that will be around in the meetings on the fringe in the next couple of days. I'd like to start exploring what kind of common Christian response there might be to the common word document that's come from the Muslim leaders. I think so far there have been one or two sort of holding responses from here and there. I'd quite like to start thinking about how we get together and take that further and respond to whatever is really fruitful and promising in that initiative from the Muslim side. Secondly, I'd quite like to raise the question about whether there's something that the churches ought to be doing together in preparation for the Bali consultation on environmental issues, on climate change. I think a corporate statement from Christian leaders on that would be a major contribution at this stage.
In response to the Muslim letter, the common word, do you have any practical ideas already, any practical ways that you'd like to see this kind of response taking shape?
Well, we've been looking at various theoretical possibilities in private conversations. I think it would be quite good if we could somehow engineer a proper face-to-face discussion with some of these people, as well as declarations going out. But how to do that is quite a logistical challenge.
You're here discussing, as I say, this theme for a world without violence. You yourself have been visiting recently one of the war-torn areas of the world in the Middle East. You've described as a harrowing experience your encounters with refugees, both those fleeing the violence in Iraq and also those who've been living in Palestinian refugee camps all their lives. Can you tell us a bit about this, about what you saw and about the impact it had on you as particularly?
The meeting with the Iraqi refugees was in the context of a Syrian Orthodox settlement not far from Damascus, where the Syrian Orthodox Church was doing sterling work in caring for refugees, some of them of their own faith, some of them Chaldeans and members of other Christian groups in Iraq. The stories we heard were dreadful stories, stories about systematic targeted brutality and slaughter of the most distressing kind. I've used the term ethnic cleansing about what some extremist groups are trying to do in Iraq, and I don't apologize for that. I think that's exactly what's happening. We hear stories of abductions, and of course in the last week we've had the two abductions of Chaldean priests in Iraq. We heard stories of murder and repeated death threats, people being driven away from their homes by threats of assassination, by actual attacks, people not knowing what had happened to sons and daughters who'd been abducted. And we met, I suppose, about 300 refugees that afternoon, and we couldn't begin to listen to all the stories, but I suppose we heard several dozen such stories, enough to give us a flavour of the huge scale of the problem that's now there. Syria itself is buckling under the strain of looking after a million-plus Iraqi refugees, and they, of course, have begun to close their borders more regularly, begun to impose stricter visa controls. That in itself is impacting on this refugee community. Educated young people have had their training interrupted. We met some people who'd been in higher education in Iraq and had to abandon that. And of course, children growing up in refugee camps, that always has to be one of the worst nightmares of all. The day after, when I went to visit one of the Palestinian camps near Beirut, I met people who'd been there for 58 or so years, who'd come there as children and grown into adulthood there in the camp. I met children of 5 and 6 who were starting their lives in the camp with very little feeling that they'd ever be out of it. And there again, a community just practically and materially very much stretched and under-resourced, with one part-time physician in effect coming in a day and a half a week. No proper perinatal care, and the future stretching out. What is extraordinary is, in that particular camp, what a level of positive, active initiative there is among people there, in education, particularly in care for the young and women between each other, with very little help from outside, except one or two devoted organizations. So it was a period of 2 days when I realized, perhaps more fully than I ever had before, that in the Middle East at the moment, we have quite simply an unprecedented refugee problem. Not probably since 1945 have we seen so concentrated a problem of displaced persons. Now, in the aftermath of the Second World War, displaced persons were part of the geography of Europe and indeed the Mediterranean world. We're now rapidly reproducing that in a far more inflamed, embittered context. The presence of these refugee communities is a constant irritant, a source of resentment, fear, and despair in a region which already has more than its share of those things. And I dread to think what the impact could be of renewed cycles of violence in the region, whether it's another cycle of violence in Lebanon, whether it's some foolish and ill-thought-out attack by a Western power on one of these countries. It'll simply inflame a problem which is already spiralling out of control.
It must be very hard for you to offer words of hope, encouragement to these people.
There's very little to be said. They need a listening ear, and just the fact of a listening ear is something. It's possible to come back and try to be an advocate for them, and as it happened, I was able last week to speak directly about some of these issues with the Home Secretary. But there are no short, comforting answers you can give to these people, because the background of their suffering is so complex, so deep now.
You met also, didn't you, with a wide range of the Muslim and Christian leaders in Syria and Lebanon. What else really can they, if anything, particularly the Christian leaders there, what else can they really do to try and help these people and to try and ease the tensions that are still there?
The historic Christian communities in Syria and Lebanon, of course, have a long, long history of living constructively, patiently, alongside Muslim neighbours. And what they all feel, I think, is that they are being slowly squeezed out of the geopolitics. slowly marginalized in their own historic homelands, and so they feel perhaps more powerless than ever, more vulnerable, because they're identified with the West in some people's eyes. That being said, I think they achieve extraordinary things in refugee care, particularly having seen what the Syrian Orthodox do, having seen what some of the volunteer groups do in Beirut. I can't praise them too highly. I think there's enormous commitment there. In terms of political leverage, of course, they have very, very little, even in Lebanon now, where the Maronite community is smaller than it was. The overall Christian population is now probably less than half because of mass immigration. And that's the thing that most of all frustrates what would be the proper aspirations, I think, of Christians in that region.
You've also said that support for these refugees, for the camps that are there to look after them, is actually decreasing. I mean, is this an issue that's going off the radar now?
I think there's a bit of danger that that will happen. Certainly in the Beirut camp, we heard about the withdrawal of some resources. And I think it is quite important that people are reminded this problem may be an old one, not particularly fresh in the region, but it's as real as it ever was. And as a matter of fact, it is growing day by day.
You went also to Armenia, didn't you, where you signed a joint communique with the leader of the Armenian church there. Tell us a bit about the significance of this in terms of the dialogue.
The Church of England and the Armenian Church have got quite a long record of friendly relationships. Archbishop Davidson of Canterbury, 100 years ago, was one of those who kept the plight of the Armenians in the last days of the Ottoman Empire very much in the eyes of the government of the day. And that seems not to have been forgotten in Armenia. People do sort of recognise that the Archbishop of Canterbury was their friend at a difficult time. So the welcome was very warm. I've met the Catholicos of Armenia before, more than once, and I think we've become good friends in the last few years. What we are interested in there is not just pursuing theological dialogue, but asking what can be done to help the Armenian Church as it deals with a lot of new opportunities that are arising. In the Soviet period, it was not possible for the Armenian Church to do very much that was creative in response to a changing society. Now that's altered completely, of course. It's a new kind of society, it's a new nation. The church is a public commentator in a way that it hasn't been for a long time, but even more importantly, the church is there dealing with the pastoral fallout of social change, dealing with ongoing human problems. One thing I particularly wanted to do was to see what they were doing in prison ministry. A few years ago, I met an Armenian priest visiting Wales who was exploring how to create prison chaplaincies in Armenia, and I was able, to my delight, to meet him again near Yerevan to visit a prison for women and young people and to see how chaplaincy was developing there, which was hugely impressive. I was also able to see the youth and community work done by the Armenian Church and the equivalent of council estates around Yerevan, the new building projects with all their problems, and also to visit a church where the parish priest had pioneered Armenian sign language for the deaf, had produced the first Armenian manual of sign language, the first ever, and had produced a DVD of the liturgy of the Armenian Church in sign language. Now that is, I think, creative thinking and suggests the Armenian Church has a tremendous reservoir of energy and flexibility and imagination to deal with its society. So that was a very encouraging visit.
You also visited, didn't you, the genocide memorial there in Yerevan. Now, of course, this question of recognising the genocide has flared again, causing tensions between the US and Turkey. What do you think? You talked, didn't you, to the president and the prime minister there in Armenia. Can you tell us anything about those conversations and what else perhaps you can do? You mentioned the role of the Archbishop of Canterbury in the past in trying to help the Armenians deal with this. What can you do today, perhaps, to help this situation?
In very general terms, I think Armenia is a country that's poised to be a very good friend to Western Europe and needs its advocates, needs its sympathisers in the West. I'm more than happy to be one of those friends. In terms of the genocide question, I think anyone who's been round the museum in Yerevan will not be particularly interested in discussing the finer points of whether there are enough people for it to count as a genocide. What happened was a series of targeted and highly efficient mass killings, which reduced the overall Armenian population by perhaps a third. What do you want to call it? Well, you might start by calling it an inhuman outrage. And while there are many Turkish people who will say, and Turks also suffered in that period, and there were mass killings and violent treatment of Turkish people in that period, yes, that's true. But I think recognizing the one doesn't mean you obliterate the memory of the other. I hope and pray that as Turkey moves towards closer relationships with the rest of Europe, it'll find the national confidence that allows it to say, well, of course terrible things were done in our name in the past.
The visit to Armenia, to Syria and to Lebanon came on the heels of an encounter you had in New Orleans with the Episcopal Church of America. Now, before that meeting, there were the usual grim predictions of schism and so on within the Anglican Communion. What were your impressions of the meeting, and how much did what went on there help to avert, if we can call it that, this crisis that we keep hearing about?
Well, as you say, it's almost a ritual part of the description that this is the meeting where it'll all be settled. Most meetings in human history aren't like that, actually. What I sensed was a very, very strong commitment on the part of most of the American bishops there to the Anglican Communion, but a lot of uncertainty about how that was to be worked through, and perhaps in some circles still an assumption that that could be simply on the terms of the American Church. That is to say, awareness of the conflicts, awareness of the tensions, but perhaps not quite much sense of what initiatives needed to be taken from there to mend fences. Now, I think what we ended up with was a carefully crafted statement which moved perhaps about as far as the American bishops as a unit could go. That's already being crawled over, every comma being subject to microscopic examination in the last week or two. What I'm hoping is that we'll have some slightly more balanced, reasoned responses from all around the communion. I've invited those, they're beginning to come in, and I hope that by the beginning of November I'll be in a position to digest and summarise those and take things on to the next step. So it's a very mixed picture, I'd say. It's hard to doubt the willingness of the American Church to be part of the communion. It's not so clear that all of them, at least, understand quite what that might involve in terms of finding ways of, as we've said more than once, walking together, which involve putting certain things on hold.
So in terms of the next step that you're talking about, you're waiting for the responses.
The next step is finding out what the primates of the communion and some of the other councils of the communion want to say. Obviously, it has some knock-on effect on the Lambeth Conference next year and how people are approaching that, and that's one of the questions remaining to be settled. So in the next month or so, I think one of my main tasks will be drawing all that together, working out what the next step is, what sort of consultation, if any, needs to happen beyond that.
You remain very optimistic despite these difficulties that you're dealing with constantly in terms of this division between the communion. Well, what are your hopes really ahead of Lambeth?
Well, as I've said more than once, optimism isn't what I always feel, but hope is, you know, obligatory for a Christian. I still hope that we're able to survive as a communion that is willing to make decisions together, not in bits and pieces. And that's obviously as much a problem for those in the global south who are performing irregular ordinations as it is for Americans ordaining people in active gay relationships. How do we make decisions together? How do we make decisions that are responsible to one another? And I think for that to happen, we need a very, very strong doctrine of what I, as an old-fashioned Anglican, would call the Catholicity of the Anglican Church. That is, that we're not simply a series of local enterprises. We do attempt to behave as a global church where each local church is fed by, nourished by the wider church and the other way around. We haven't got that balance right at the moment. I would hope and pray that we get it better.